Our Torah portion this week is called Vayeshuv, which means, and he settled, or and he dwelt. And it begins in Genesis chapter 37 and verse 1. And I know that somewhere in here in this part of Genesis, the verse numbers between the Hebrew Bible that I'm using and the English Bibles that you might be using, sometimes the verse numbers are staggered a little bit. I think there might be some places in this section where that happens. So if I say a verse and it's not the right verse, well, just look a verse or two ahead or behind and you'll find it. And also, some weeks I'll ask you ahead of time to hold questions and comments to the end. This is not one of those weeks. There's so much packed in here, I'm not even going to try to cover it all. I'm going to get us started, and then I want to invite you to ask questions, to share insights. We'll let you kind of determine the direction of this teaching. Be sensitive to the people around you and to the people who listen on the internet and the CDs, that when you ask a question or whatever, there are hundreds and hundreds of people who hear it. So speak loud. I'll try to repeat the questions when you say them. But I just want you to be mindful that there's more than just the people here who are listening. So be valuable the time. But ask the questions. Make sure you don't hesitate. Ask a good question. We love good questions. They can't be beat. So I want to start with this. There's no character, and if you've studied with us at all over the past years, you know this already, but if you haven't, it's very important that you realize this, that there is no character in the entire Hebrew Scriptures whose life more closely parallels that of our Messiah, Yeshua, than Joseph. Joseph is an amazing individual, an incredible individual. And there are at least 50 or 60 parallels that we'll point out over this week and the weeks to come where his life parallels that of Messiah. Now, we could easily add many, many more. And there'll probably be several that you will add as well. But, Jason's coming up. Oh, okay. He's going to start his own show. So when you think of Yeshua, now Yeshua's mother's name was Mary, and her husband's name was Joseph. So going to school, Yeshua would have been known as Yeshua ben Yosef, Yeshua son of Joseph, though Joseph was actually his adopted father. But God could have picked any great Hebrew name for his father, but he picked this one, because Joseph is the one who so closely parallels Yeshua that Yeshua should be called Ben Yosef, because his life is so much like that of Joseph. Now, as we go through this, I want you to keep something in mind. Joseph lived well over 1,000 years, closer to 1,500 years or so, before Yeshua was born. Yet God knows in from the beginning. He saw every detail so perfectly. So I'm going to give you this list from the overhead first. Now, if you want to write these down, fine. If you don't, you can print these off from the internet. They'll be there later this evening. But let's just go through a few of these. When we meet Joseph, he's a shepherd. You might be thinking, well, Yeshua was a carpenter or stonemason, one or the other. Yeah, but he was also the good shepherd, he tells us. And he's the king of Israel. And as a king, he's considered to be the shepherd of Israel. Joseph was a mediator. We see Joseph talking to his father about his brothers and bringing reports about his brothers to the father. And he was sent from the father to go and visit his brothers. He was the most beloved of the father. Jacob loved all of his sons, but Joseph was special. He was raised with sons of weakness, because when we first see Joseph, he is spending time with the sons of Bilhah. And Bilhah means weakness. And he was there with those sons. He is a son of wisdom. Now, you might miss this a little bit, but in verse 5, if you look at verse 5 of our chapter, it says, "Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons, since he was a child of his old age." In Hebrew, that phrase is ben zikunim. Ben zikunim, son of his old age. Zakain means old. Zikunim means of his older times, his older years. And I don't know what that, if I were to have a bunch of sons, I don't know if I'd love my last one when I'm an old man more than the rest. But possibly when you get up in years, you've got 12 sons and lots of daughters, that one that comes up there near the end is the one you love the best. I don't know. But the sages put another spin on this, because a zikunim is one who's filled with wisdom. And in fact, in the Aramaic, if you have a Hebrew Bible, over to the left should be a column that has the Aramaic translation, and it translates that this way, bar chachim. Chacham means wise. He was a son of wisdom. And that's how the Aramaic translates this, that Joseph was a son of wisdom. He was filled with wisdom. And we go on. He was the firstborn. You say, well, wait a minute, Grant. He was the 11th born. He was the 11th son. Okay, I'll grant you that. Technically, he was. But remember, who was Joseph's mother? Rachel. Who was the one who Jacob fell in love with and wanted to marry first? Rachel. It was his father-in-law who slipped in the wrong bride on the wedding night, slipped in Rachel's sister Leah instead of Rachel. But if it had been up to Jacob, he would have had one wife. It would have been Rachel, and Rachel's firstborn son was Joseph. So you could say, in spiritually speaking, Joseph was Jacob's firstborn, and Jacob at least thought of him as that. He thought of Joseph as being his firstborn. He was hated without a cause. Yeshua said, they hated me without a cause. The Talmud says that Herod's temple is destroyed due to sinat chinam, hatred without a cause. And we find here with Joseph, his brothers hated it for no reason. They were jealous of him and they hated him. He is given spiritual and physical rule. How do we see that? Joseph has two dreams. His two dreams, the first dream is found starting in verse 5. Joseph dreamt a dream, which he told to his brothers, and they hated him even more. He said to him, hear, if you please, the dream which I dreamt. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the middle of the field, when behold, my sheaf arose and also remained standing, and then behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf. Now let's take a look what that means. This dream takes place in the field. What is the field always a picture of? The world. It's harvest time. We're talking agriculture, we're talking dirt, we're talking growth, we're talking about physical things. And listen to what Joseph says. He says, my sheaf arose. And then the other sheaves gathered around and then bowed down. So that means his sheaf somehow was down and then came up. Well, theirs were up and then went down and bowed to him. This is a prophetic hint towards the resurrection of Messiah. And in a figurative way, Joseph, who was treated as dead, thrown into a hole, brought and sold for silver, by the way, brought out of the hole and sent among the Gentiles, and when he later meets with his brothers, it's almost like a resurrection. But then he has a second dream. He has a second dream. Verse 9, he dreamt another dream and related it to his brothers. And he said, look, I dreamt another dream. I'm sure they said, oh, goody. Behold, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me. There's nothing about rising this time. He just says, there I was, the sun, the moon, the stars bowed down to me. This is in the heavenlies. This isn't in the earth, in the field. This is using spiritual imagery. What you see here are two dreams which represent prophecies of Yeshua's first coming to the field, where his sheaf rises out of the dirt and his brothers come to worship him, come to submit to him, I should say. And then the second dream is a picture of his return, when all the universe, All the universe recognizes him. So it's a picture of physical and spiritual rule. It's a picture of Messiah's first coming and his second coming. And there's a lot more detail we could get into with that, but we're going to move on. He was sent by the Father. Jacob sent him. He arrived in the field, it specifically says, and when he gets to the field where his brothers are supposed to be, they're not there. And a man meets him in the field where his brothers are supposed to be, and the man asks him, "Who do you seek?" He says, "My brothers do I seek." And Yeshua was sent to earth to seek out the lost sheep of Israel, to seek his brothers. And the man told him, "Well, they're not here. They were, but I overheard them say that they're going to go to Dothan." That is over in verse 17. The man said, "They journeyed on from here, for I heard them saying, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. You know what Dothan means? Dothan means double law. When Yeshua came, the sons of Israel had moved from the place of a Torah lifestyle to a place of great legalism, of tremendous legalism, where they had taken God's Torah and done the thing that God had forbidden man to do, and that is to add to his word. We are not to add to it, and that's what the Jewish people have done. But we're also commanded not to take away from it, and that is what the church has done. Both are guilty. Gentile believers have taken away from the Torah, says you don't need to do those things. The Jews have added to the Torah, say, "Well, you must do these things." The Torah is perfect just the way it is. This is why I find my home here in Messianic Judaism, what you might call Christian Judaism, that I love the Torah. I try to submit my life to the commandments of Torah best I can, and I embrace Yeshua as my Messiah, and I find that his yoke is not a difficult one. It is not a hard one. It brings freedom and blessing and peace, and we can go on and on and on. It's a wonderful way to live. But if the enemy cannot get us to take away from something, he'll get us to add to it. If he cannot hold our foot back from progress, he'll try to give us a shove to where we overshoot the mark. This is the way the enemy works. One extreme or the other extreme, I don't care which extreme, as long as it is an extreme. But balance, the bullseye, is what the enemy hates. He hates that. Now, did I see a hand up here, Mikkel? Yes, go ahead. The question is, why did Joseph share these dreams with his brothers when that's what basically got him sold to the slaves? We could ask the same question. Why did Yeshua talk about how God is his Father and he was sent by God and he pointed out many of the sins of the legalists of his day when those are the things that got him killed? What kind of tone do you think he had when he was saying this? What kind of tone did Joseph had when he shared these dreams? That's a good question. I'd love to have been a fly on the wall or whatever to hear this. But I know that the sages tend to think Joseph should have kept his mouth shut. And maybe he should have. But God had a bigger picture in mind. He wanted to paint a picture of Messiah 1,500 years or so before Messiah was born. So he spoke what God had shared with him. He spoke it, and that caused his brothers to hate him. And Yeshua did the same. Well, did he know what they meant before he shared them? How could he not? Maybe he's just like, "I'm amazed. This does not make sense to me. Listen to what these dreams, how can this be?" I don't know. Fred, I saw your hand up.
Mm-hmm. For the Pharisees to find a way to do it. Yes.
So Fred is saying how Messiah's miracles escalated from water to wine to the resurrection of Lazarus, and the more he did to prove who he was, the more they were determined to kill him, put him to death. Yeah, it's one of the interesting things, though, I want to point out is that when he shared these dreams, Jacob, it sounds like he's correcting him. If you look at verse 10, now this is the way the Art Scroll translation translates it. And he related it to his father and to his brothers. His father scolded him. But that's not what the word means. The word there that they translate scolded is not scold. It's the word ga'ar. And the word ga'ar means to limit, to inhibit. It wasn't to scold. It wasn't to chew him out. But his father limited his speech. He put a restriction. And when you see how this word is used, it's used, I don't know, a dozen times or so in the scriptures. It always has to do with inhibiting and limiting. And what did Yeshua say? He says, I only speak the things that my father tells me to speak. In other words, I could really run off and tell you all the sins I see. And here's picture this for a second. You know how you see faults in one another and you just have to talk about it? Here's Yeshua, he's perfect. And it says he saw what was in the heart of every man. Every person he met was flawed. Some were deeply, deeply flawed, and he saw every single flaw, yet he didn't talk about it all the time. He pointed them out at certain times, but he inhibited his own speech. He says, I only speak the things my father tells me to say. That's it. Just what he permits me to say. But boy, he could have said a lot, couldn't he? Could have said a lot. Well, let's go on a bit further. They conspired to kill him, just as the leaders in Messiah's day conspired to kill him. He was stripped of his garment, just as Yeshua was. And what's interesting is that this garment, you know how you in Sunday school you would hear how it was a coat of many colors, and maybe it was. What it says is that it's a ketonet pasim, and we don't really know what that word pasim means. And so the sages come up with all these brilliant ideas. One sage says it means it was long-sleeved. Usually a ketonet did not, would it be like a tunic, maybe not have sleeves. Other times it did. But this was a long-sleeved tunic, which would have been unusual for a young man of 17 years of age to wear. Another one says it's pasim because it comes from a word, hafeset, I believe is the word, which means to cast lots. And that when, are you ready for this? And this sage says, this ancient sage, that when they stripped Joseph of his tunic and dipped it in the goat's blood, they cast lots for it to see who would have to take it back to Jacob. And, of course, we know that when Yeshua was crucified, they cast lots for his garment as well. Another thing about this word pasim, it's four letters in Hebrew. It's Pei, Samek, Yud, Mem. They say those four letters stand for the four people or groups to whom Joseph belonged. He belonged to Potiphar, Pei. And the next letter is Samek. He belonged to the Socharim, the merchants. He belonged to the Yishmaelites. That's who his brother sold him to. And to the Midianites. You see, the four people who owned him. If you take those four groups, we see that they start with Pei, Samek, Yud, and Mem. Now, there's a spiritual insight here I want to share with you. His father gave him a coat that was pasim. And we have this mysterious word. And yet the sages say, well, these four letters that spell this word represent the four groups to whom Joseph belonged. Four groups who owned him at some time. Well, think about that. Is Messiah here on earth right now? No. We're waiting for him to return. His spirit is here. The essence of him is here. But physically, he's not here. So how does he express himself? He expresses himself through those who possess him, who own him. We are his coat. You follow? We are his coat. We are the working clothes of Messiah's spirit. And just as that word pasim can be an anagram for the four individuals and groups who owned him, this coat that Messiah wears is you and me, the people who claim to have him as their own, the people in whom he expresses himself and through whom. You understand the picture? It's a wonderful picture. You all look like you don't understand a bit of it, but I'm going to stand by it. It's a wonderful insight anyway, whether you all like it or not. He was put in the ground. Messiah was put in the ground. He is betrayed by Judas. You're thinking, wait a minute. Joseph is betrayed by Judah. Well, guess what? Judah and Judas are the same name. Yehuda in Hebrew, Judas in Greek. But it's the same name. All right? Exact same name. And Judas is the one who said, let's do this. He came up with the plot. And he was sold for silver. Joseph for 20 pieces of silver, Yeshua for 30. The only way to explain that is inflation. I'm sure there's a deeper reason for that. I'm just not quite sure what it is. But he came forth from the ground alive. And then he went among the Gentiles. And I put the slaughterers there because he was, once the Ishmaelites and the Midianites had him, he was then sold to Potiphar. And it says that Potiphar was the chamberlain of the butchers, Ha-Tabachim. And one of the ways that's translated is slaughterers or butchers. Again, it's a little bit of a mysterious word. His garment was dipped in blood. Now, you may be thinking of Yeshua, that his garment wasn't dipped in blood. But figuratively, it was, because when he returns, the book of Revelation, he's wearing a garment that's dipped in blood. And then this garment is taken and presented to the Father. It's sent back to Jacob and presented to the Father. The blood of what the Father believes is the Son is sent back to the Father. It's an amazing picture. Was the opposite of Satan. We're going to skip that one for right now. I took this overhead from when we took over a year to go through Genesis, and we spent several weeks going over just this one overhead. And if you're really curious about what number 22 is, you can go back and listen to the teaching. Be real honest, I don't even remember what number 22 represents. But I have to be honest with you, I can't keep secrets. He brought blessing wherever he went. He was in Potiphar's house. Potiphar's house is blessed. Potiphar didn't have to worry about a thing. Later he's sent to prison. The prison's blessed. Everything goes great. Everything's put in Joseph's control. Everything goes hunky-dory. Later, he's brought to serve Pharaoh. He becomes the one who oversees all of Egypt, and Egypt is blessed. Wherever Joseph is recognized and given authority, he brings blessing, he brings prosperity and peace. But he was tempted. When Potiphar's wife tried to seduce him, it doesn't say he wasn't tempted. He most certainly was. And we know of Messiah that he was tempted in every respect as we are. Every respect. There is this wonderful story in the Midrash that when Joseph is being tempted by Potiphar's wife, and according to the legend, she was a looker. And here he is, a young man in his late teens. And here's this woman who's beautiful, and she's available. There's nobody in the house. She's willing and ready. And he could have thought to himself, you know, my brother sold me out. They think I'm dead. Where's God? I tried to serve him, and look where it's got me. And then they sell me to these traders, and now I'm working for this guy in Egypt. What difference does it make? I might as well get what little bit of pleasure I can because life stinks. Now, that would have been the attitude probably most of us guys sitting here. But the legend goes that Joseph was just about ready to crack. He was just about ready to give in at the temptation. And he looked up and he saw a vision of his father, Jacob. He saw Dad. And when it came back alive to him that I have a father, and I know if he saw what I was doing or thinking about doing, I would break his heart. And he said no, and he fled from her. You know, if only we would think of those who love us before we give in to temptation, we might not give in to temptation so often. Especially the ones who love us, we're watching. You know? He was tempted, but he did not give in to the temptation. And then just a few more. And then next week we'll add more to our list. He was falsely accused twice. And if you go through the story of Yeshua, you'll find false accusations on two particular occasions. He lost his garment altogether. But when he was accused, he was silent. There's not one word of what Joseph said before his accuser. Not one word. Isn't this amazing? I mean, just here in a few chapters, there are 28 parallels, detailed parallels between Joseph and Yeshua. And there are a few more scattered in there, but these are some of the main ones. So, any questions or comments so far? Yes, Dale.
Just to take it a step further, I suppose some people in here probably thought of the same thing. As Yeshua is going through Jerusalem, living out those last few years of his life, he deals with the same people in those four groups that Joseph did. You could say that dealing with Potiphar was like dealing with Herod. Mm-hmm. Dealing with the merchants was like dealing with the temple merchants.
Yeah.
The traitors and tax collectors he ate and had meals with. Yeah. So there's even more.
That's interesting. Very good. Good insight. Yeah. Anybody else? Yes, Brian, Priscilla. I want to call you Patty. Priscilla.
When you mentioned that the Jews had added to Torah and the church mm-hmm.
How was the Christendom, how is it taken away from the Torah? Well, it says we don't need to keep the Sabbath. It says eat whatever you want. God said these things are forbidden. They are not even food. God has given us his appointed times and commands us to keep them. And yet those are tossed away. Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Passover. I remember I spoke at a church one Sunday evening. It happened to be on Shavuot, the day of Pentecost. And I asked him, "You know what day this is?" "Yeah, it's Sunday." "No, I mean, do you know what day it is?" "Yeah, it's June 15th or whatever." I said, "No, what's the day in the Bible?" "No idea." And then I said, "Well, today is Pentecost," and they were all excited that it was the day of Pentecost. I said, "What happened the first Pentecost?" They thought the Holy Spirit was given in Acts 2. No, I'm talking about the first Pentecost, about 1,000 years or so before that, 1,500 years or whatever. And I mean, we've been robbed of our heritage, been robbed of it. And this is just the way it's been passed down. But in these last days, God is restoring to the Jews, their Messiah, and to Christians, his Torah. And we live in an amazing time when we see the two literally becoming one. It's an amazing time. But we're missing so much. We're missing so much if we're not embracing the Torah. Of course, I'm preaching to the choir here, literally. We're missing so much of our Christian heritage when we ignore God's Torah. Our discipleship manual. So. Adam, I saw your hand up.
Yeah, I was going to go back to the strip of the garment one. I'd like to hear some more, but I was thinking just about mm-hmm. how much an individual is represented by their clothes. When you go in the average person's body, mm-hmm. you can tell who they are, what they do,
Yes.
At the same time, I kind of see, I see more of like a high schooler's closet than once you've filled out your confession.
Yeah.
I looked at things I wore in high school, and I'm like, great mercy, my clothes didn't
Yeah.
But I'm kind of thinking, with the church, there's such a large body of people that on some level attach themselves to God, and there's just that distance at the same time of like, to the world, we're saying, yeah, this is what Jesus is. I think different people have more clarity, but some people are. I think there's a lot of people out there that have a very hardened heart against Jesus, and it's strictly because of.
Ways been a certain yeah. Yeah, a lot of people are turned off about Jesus, Yeshua, because he's been so misrepresented. And a lot of people are turned off to Torah because of the way it's been so misrepresented. What we need to do is go to the source. We need to read what the Word says about the Word, what the Word says about the living Word, the Word made flesh. Let's go to the source, and instead of all the consultants who claim to understand. And when people go back to the Bible itself, begin to read, it seems like all of a sudden the fog starts to clear. You have to come to it with honest hearts.
How do we make a point rather than misrepresent?
How do we represent? Well, that's every person's going to answer that in a different way. And the way I represent him now is different from the way I did 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. Because we're children. We outgrow our little clothes, and we have to put on bigger clothes if we're growing spiritually. And so what happens? We grow up into full stature, and that's our goal: to grow up into the fullness of Messiah. And all of us are somewhere on that spectrum. So. You know, does a little child represent his father well? Well, does a grown son represent his father well? Yeah, but they do it in very different ways. Okay, with a little child, I may look at his manners, and I may look at how he's dressed. Is he dressed? Is he clean? Does he look healthy? Are his manners good? Then I realize he's been taken care of. But with the adult son, I'm going to be looking at how he thinks and how he weighs things and how he reacts in certain situations. I'm looking for other signs that tell me if he's representing his father. So, again, how we represent him can change over time and should change. I think, Joe, your hand's up first. Or were you pointing over here to Ben? Okay. All right, Ben?
Just to add to that, I was just thinking about how certain people, certain friends you have in your life, they tend to draw out certain parts of you that maybe other people don't. There's certain parts of your personality that just certain people, when you hang out with them, they draw it out of you. And so you get to see, and when you're in a community of people, you get to see how the full version of what this person truly is, because you have all these people drawing out these different parts of this person.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of a part of
understanding
is when we live in a faith community like this, and we don't isolate ourselves, and we worship together, I think you get a bigger picture of who God is.
Absolutely. Because we're all parts of a body. We're not a complete body in ourselves. Yes. Yeah, very good. Good point. Okay, Joe. Yes.
So there's a connection there too.
Yeah. You bring up something I hadn't even thought about talking about today. Let me just give a little nutshell version now, and let's go into that in more detail in one of the coming weeks while we're talking about Joseph. Probably the last week when we get to chapter 49. But what Joe's referring to is that in Judaism, they actually, there's some confusion about the Messiah. There was a lot of confusion about Messiah, and not just in Judaism. But there's a theme in Judaism that there are two Messiahs coming. There is what's called Mashiach ben Yosef, Messiah son of Joseph, and Mashiach ben David, Messiah son of David. And the reason they've come up with these two pictures of coming messiahs is because when they look at messianic prophecy in the scriptures, they find prophecies that go in one pile that suggest that Messiah will suffer and die and be rejected. He'll be humble. He'll ride on a donkey into Jerusalem. And he's one who's, he's just lowly and kind of rejected. But then they look at this other category of messianic prophecies, that he comes and he rules and he reigns and he fights the enemies of Israel and throws them out and he elevates Jerusalem and it's peace on earth. He comes riding in on a white horse and he comes in like David as a ruling king. And they don't know how to reconcile this category of prophecies with this category of prophecies, but they know they both refer to the Messiah. So they talk about two Messiahs. But they do teach that Mashiach ben Yosef must come before Mashiach ben David. Well, what we realize is that there are not two Messiahs. There's one Messiah who comes at two different times. And the first time Yeshua came, he came as Messiah son of Joseph. And no wonder God assigned Mary's husband's name as Joseph. And he came riding on a donkey. He was rejected of men. He was a friend of sinners and so on. And his life paralleled that of Joseph's. But when he returns, it's going to be like King David. Come in riding on a horse. He'll be doing battle establishing his kingdom on earth in a powerful way, in a way that every eye will see him. And so that's what Joseph's referring to. So I guess I don't need to talk about it when we get to chapter 49 now, do we? Tell you what, we're going to move on a little bit. There are a couple other things I want to get to. You know, as you go through chapter 37, you see everything set up with Joseph, his brothers selling him for silver, getting rid of him, presenting his blood-soaked coat to the father, and Jacob going into grief. He rends his garments, and he mourns for Joseph many days. And then the narrative picks up in chapter 39. And we see Joseph arriving in Egypt. Potiphar purchases him, puts him in charge of the house. Joseph is tempted by Potiphar's wife. And you know the story so well. And what's interesting is in chapter 39 is the only place in the narrative of Joseph, which goes from chapter 37 to the end of Genesis. This is the only place in the story of Joseph's life where God's name is mentioned, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. It's not mentioned anywhere else. Just in chapter 39. And it's not mentioned once, it's mentioned eight times in that one chapter. Something to draw your attention to. And then you go to chapter 40. And here now he's in the prison. You know, about the time you think, you know, things are bad, they go to worse. Now he's not in a house anymore serving Potiphar. He's in a prison. He's in a prison. He's in a rat hole, basically. But never one word of complaint do we hear from Joseph. Not a single word. Not once. And while he's there, there are two of the chamberlains of Pharaoh. One's a cupbearer. And one is a baker. What does a cupbearer do? He makes wine and presents it to the king. What does a baker do? He makes the bread and presents the bread to the king. Do you see this theme of wine and bread? It's a reference back to the Passover, where we take the bread and we take the cup. It represents the body. It represents the blood. But these two men, what happens to them is completely different. The cupbearer is restored to his position with Pharaoh and puts the blood back in his hand. Again, the blood being presented to the father, being presented to the king. What happens to the body of the baker? He is killed. He is either hanged on a tree or impaled. We're not quite sure what. And then it says the birds of the air come and eat his flesh. Not a pretty picture. Why such opposite things? Because this echoes the theme that about the blood and the body of the Lamb, the blood and the body of the Messiah. Let's go to the story of Passover. You take the Passover lamb. What do you do with this blood? You put it on the outside of the door, and God says, when I see the blood's for me, he's saying. It's for me to see. You present the blood to me by putting it on the door of your house. The body of the lamb, you take in, you roast it, you eat it, eat all of it, don't leave anything over. It's consumed. And then you go to Yom Kippur. You have the goats. They represent one sacrifice. We have two identical goats bought with one piece of money. Lots are cast upon them. One goat bears the sins of Israel. It's the only place in the Bible where you see a sacrifice bearing the sins of people. And it's driven to the wilderness. His body is pushed over a cliff and it dies. What happens to the other goat? Its blood is shed and its blood is taken into the Holy of Holies. It's taken before the Father, before the King. You see the picture? And then we come to two goats again. Did you notice the two goats in the story today? There are two goats here. What did they dip Joseph's cloak in? The blood of a goat. And that coat with the blood is presented to the Father. Right? Where's the other goat show up? The other goat's in chapter 38. You know, if you read through the story of Joseph and chapter 38 was not there, you wouldn't notice it's missing. You would not notice a gap in the narrative. Because chapter 38 has nothing to do with Joseph. Chapter 38 is all about Judah. Let's just dive into this a little bit. I saw a few hands up. We'll take those in a moment. They've sold Joseph to the slave merchants. The coat's been presented to Jacob. Judah, who engineered this whole plot, is feeling so guilty. It says it was at that time that Judah went down from his brothers. He left his brothers and turned away towards an Adullamite man whose name was Hira. There Judah saw the daughter of a Canaanite whose name was Shua. The man's name was Shua. He married her, his daughter, and consorted with her. She conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Er. She conceived again, bore a son, called his name Onan. And yet again she bore a son and called his name Shelah. Okay? So Judah marries and has three sons. Er was Ra. If you take Er's name and reverse it, Ra, it means evil. Er was evil, and that's what it says. Verse 7, but Er, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the eyes of Adonai, and Adonai caused him to die. Then Judah said to Onan, consort with, I'm sorry, this is the other place where God's name is found. I forgot there was one other place. Consort with your brother's wife and then enter levirate marriage with her, establish offspring for her. And Onan, he messes up and he dies. God kills him. So Judah takes this woman, Tamar, and says, well, just wait till Shelah grows up, then you can marry him and raise up children to his seed. But he doesn't give her to him. So what does Tamar do? She dresses like a prostitute, sits at the crossroads, waits till the day when Judah comes by. And she consorts with him, and she says, what are you going to pay me with? He says, well, I'll give you a goat. And he says, but I don't have it on me right now. I'll pay you later. Well, what will you give me as a surety for this goat? And it says, verse 18, what pledge shall I give you? She replied, your signet, your wrap, and your staff that is in your hand. He gave them to her, consorted with her, she conceived by him. Later he finds out, hey, by the way, and he doesn't know this is his daughter-in-law. He doesn't know this. She has a veil over her face. Later he finds out she's pregnant, about 3-4 months pregnant, and he says, oh, take her out, let her be burned, put her to death. She's an adulteress. So they're taking her out, and she says, I'm pregnant by the man to whom these belong. And she holds up the wrap and the signet and the staff. And then what does Judas say? She is more righteous than I am. Now, here's the interesting thing. I want you to notice this. Go back to chapter 37 for a moment. Verse 32. This is back when they took Joseph's cloak, dipped in the goat's blood, and sent it back to Jacob. They dispatched the fine woolen tunic, and they brought it to their father and said, "We found this." And then in Hebrew it says, "Haker na." Two words, "Haker na." Identify, please. Is it your son's tunic or not? Haker na. Those words are found only one other place in Scripture, and that's in chapter 38. When Tamar is being dragged out to be put to death, verse 38-25, as she was taken out, she sent word to her father-in-law, saying, "By the man to whom these belong, I am with child." She said, "Haker na." Identify, please. Whose are this signet, this wrap, and this staff? You know that is that poetic justice that your sin will find you out? When he heard those words, don't you know everything had to come flooding back? "I deceived my father concerning the death of my brother. And I was deceived by my daughter-in-law. My act was an unrighteous one. Her act, though, was a very righteous one." And then twins are born out of this union. Perez and Zerah. Perez becomes an ancestor of Yeshua. So we see two goats again. One goat's blood is put on the cloak presented to the father. But the other goat never even makes an appearance. Never gets eaten, never gets killed, never given to Tamar. Instead, what she gets are things for her. You see, according to Jewish law, he should have given his third son to her to marry so that that son could raise up seed in the name of the older dead brothers. And Judah didn't follow through. So Tamar says, "I'll take the matter in my own hands. I'll have Judah become the father." She had to deceive him, but he became the father. He gave her sons. And why did she insist on the signet ring, the cloak, and the staff? Because these are symbols of what a husband provides a wife. The wrap is the covering. It's the protection. You understand? And a husband is to provide a covering and protection for his wife. The signet is his identity. It's a signet ring. It's like his signature. In other words, "I want your name. I want your identity and my identity to become one." And then the staff represents his strength and his livelihood. Okay? He was a shepherd. The staff represented his occupation. And she says, "I want your livelihood and your strength, your leadership to be mine." She took the symbols from me. "I don't want any goat. I want you. I want you as a husband because that's what you owe me. You've withheld your son. You've broken the law. I'll take you instead." What we see here is that Judah messes up two times, and yet both times comes up smelling like roses. What if Judah had not sold his brother Joseph into slavery? And if Joseph had not gone down to Egypt? Egypt would have starved. Judah and his brothers would have starved. His father Jacob would have starved. But because they did this evil thing to the younger brother Joseph, God used it to save the known world at that time, as you'll see in the weeks to come. And if Judah had not consorted with his daughter-in-law, not even knowing it was her, if he hadn't done this, if he hadn't messed up and then done this thing instead, this ancestor, this wonderful picture of Messiah would not have been born. Because you notice how the birth went, the twins? This is hair-raising. She has twins, right? Chapter 38, verse 27. "It came to pass at the time she gave birth that, behold, there were twins in her womb." Now, try to pay attention to this without getting too distracted with the gore. "And it happened as she gave birth, one of the twins," one of the babies, you get the picture now, "put out a hand. The midwife took a crimson thread and tied it on his hand, saying, "This one emerged first." And it was as he drew back his hand. The baby puts his hand out of the womb. The midwife ties a scarlet thread. Now, scarlet thread is always a picture of the bloodline of Messiah. It's always a picture of Messiah. It's a picture of his death. Hand comes out, gets a red string, hand disappears back in the womb. Then his twin brother's born without the red string. And it was as he drew back his hand that, behold, his brother emerged, and she said, "With what strength you asserted yourself?" And he called his name Perez. Perez means to break forth. Afterwards, his brother, on whose hand was the crimson thread, came out, and he called his name Zerah, which means brightness or shining. What in the world is this picturing? It's picturing Messiah again, his two comings. When Messiah came to the world the first time, was it permanent or temporary? Temporary. The hand of God, Messiah came in as the hand of God into the world just for a short time, just long enough to where we could kill him, and then he withdrew from the world. In the meantime, Perez, breaking forth, is born. Perez is a picture of us who follow this Messiah. And then Zerah makes a second appearance, but this time he comes out and he comes forth to stay. And he says, "Look," well, he doesn't say this, but picture. "It's me. See the red thread? Like Messiah comes, say, see my hands, my feet, my side, that it's me? It's the same one who was here before. Here I'm back, this time to stay. I'm not leaving this time." You understand? Get the picture? This is so full of pictures and images of Messiah. It's unbelievable. But we do believe it because we have faith. But it's amazing. What an incredible God we serve who can write all of this in detail so far ahead of time. What kind of God we must have. You know, this kind of God you can trust. You know, if there's a one or two or three parallels, okay, maybe it's coincidence. But when we find 28 in these chapters, and then more that I didn't put in the list, and there's a lot more to come, then you begin to realize God's got this figured out. He does all things well. And what a Savior we've got. What an amazing, incredible Savior we have. Just amazing. Caleb.
One of the neat things, too, is in Judaism, I know that the revelation of Joseph to his brothers is one of the key moments in all the Torah.
Oh, yes.
And,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, oh, I love the ending of the story where he's reunited with his brothers. Can you imagine the shock when they find out that their brother Joseph is alive? And Jacob, when he finds out he's alive.
And then the other thing I want to say is, people might notice that when we were saying Messiah, then David, his son Solomon, is a true picture of Messiah.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, the sages have this saying that every verse of the Torah, every verse of the Hebrew Scriptures is about the Messiah. That's what they say. Every verse is about the Messiah. Some verses it's easier to see how much it's about Messiah than others. These, it's like God's shouting at us. Look at this. This is my son. This is the Messiah. This is who he is. You can rest assured. Yes, Jim.
What's the significance of the Messiah coming from the tribe of Judah?
Well, I tell you what. Let's finish with that. I tell you, Rosemary, you have a question, and we'll answer Jim's, and we'll close in prayer.
The staff you talked about with Jesus, the shepherd of the flock. The representation of the shepherd would also be the shepherd of the flock.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, right. And she put the red thread in her window. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that red thread is pretty amazing. Well, here, let's go through this. We'll finish with this. This is wonderful stuff here. Jim is asking the question, what is the significance of Judah being the tribe from which Messiah comes? Well, let's start with this. Here is how the name David looks. If I were to show it to you, well, it's not in a Torah scroll here, but if I were to show you in a scroll, this is how the name David appears. I'm using the fancy kind of lettering that is used in making Torah scrolls. Okay? It's Dalet, Vav, Dalet. Okay? Looks like this. D, V, D. All right? Dalet, Vav, Dalet. That's David. David. All right? Everybody see that? Now, if we take God's name, which is Yud, He, Vav, He, we turn David's name into God's name by adding three yuds. I'll make these hollow. We put a yud here. We put a yud inside the dalet, which changes it from a dalet to a he. And we do the same thing here. So we see now we have yud, he, vav, he by adding three dalets. Dalet is, three yuds. Yud is the smallest letter of the alphabet. It's the jot that Yeshua refers to with the jot and tittles. It represents God's spirit. Now, God was aware of this, and David was probably aware of this, but when the scriptures say that David, Dalet Vav Dalet, was a man after God's own heart, we see that at the heart of God's name is David. And Messiah is the son of David, okay? Because when you look at David's life, he's anointed as king, but he's living in the wilderness, fleeing from Solomon, who's trying to kill him. Then later, after Solomon dies, David is anointed as king a second time. This time he rules on the throne. It's a picture of Messiah's first coming and his second coming. Has he come as king? Yeah. King of the Jews. He was crowned. But he's rejected by those in authority. Yet we are like the band of men and women who followed David in the wilderness. He's the king, but nobody recognizes him as king but us, and we follow him. But the day is coming when he'll be publicly anointed as king in front of the whole world, and then everyone will know that he's really the king. Now, why am I showing these to you? Because if you take and add another dalet right in here, between the Vav and the He, you now have Yud, He, Vav, Dalet, He. And what does that spell? That spells Yehuda, Judah. Does it make sense? All right. So, working it backwards. Judah, Yehuda, is God's name with a Dalet inside of it. And what does the letter Dalet represent? What does the name Dalet mean? It means door. Door. So in the tribe of Judah, we find the door to God, Yud Heh Vav Heh. This is why Messiah comes through that tribe. He is the door to God. Okay? And he's the son of David. Make sense? We could go on, but our time is already left. It went ahead of us. It left without us, so we better close in prayer. But as we go through the story of Joseph, as we complete Genesis here over the next few weeks, I invite you to bring questions and comments. I want you to help guide the teaching as we go through these, okay? Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you so much for your many blessings, all your goodness to us. Thank you for your amazing and wonderful Torah. David prayed, Adonai, open my eyes that I may behold wonders out of your Torah. And Father, I think we've beheld some wonders from your Torah today. Wonders that David himself didn't see because he lived before Yeshua, the Messiah, came. So Lord, I pray we would see the things that you have there for us. And we'd be faithful to study your word and open our hearts to receive what you would feed us. And we'll give you praise for it all in the precious name of Yeshua, our Savior, our Lord, and our Messiah. Amen.